Day, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW, building a more compassionate world, one broadcast at a time.
I'm Weezy Muntali, host of Africa Now, and you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Welcome to WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. This is the Hour of We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and I thank you, listener, for joining us. WPFW is a Pacifica Foundation radio station. Its theme is Jazz and Justice. It's being brought to you by listeners like yourselves because you provide us with financial and social support. And for that, I'm grateful. For those of you who are new to We the People, it's basically a weekly news magazine covering the issues of history, politics, race, and culture, particularly how they intersect, particularly how people have worked with those issues in the past, present, and future. It's part of what I think is the fulfillment of the mission of this station, which is to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. Without further ado, our topic for today, freedom versus narcissism, is our future in jeopardy? Whether in the United States or the world, narcissism, combined with racism, critically combined that is, threatens us all, particularly communities of color. What is the become of our future? To help us explore these questions, Daniel, historian Daryl Collins is with us. He's a contributing writer with Al Jazeera English Opinions, and a freelance writer who has written on topics of education reform, social justice, multiculturalism, American and African-American identity, American racism, American narcissism, and he's done all that for more than 20 years. Dr. Collins received his PhD in history from Carnegie Mellon University. Besides teaching in the areas of American history and education, he has served as an assistant director of the New Voices Fellowship Program at the Academy for Educational Development, a program for emerging leaders in the social justice field. He has written Fear of a Black America, Multiculturalism, and the African American Experience, and Spinning Sage's Goal, Allegories on the Western-Dominated Present and a Possible Post-Western Future. That's his third book and his latest book. It is the engine of our conversation. Dr. Collins, welcome. Pleasure to have you this morning.
Thank you for having me again, David. Appreciate it.
We'll just hop right into it. You have spent a decade or two making observations and writing, and you're presenting us with a theme of narcissism. Can you talk about the evolution and interpretation of what you've been seeing evolve, particularly here in the good old United States?
Sure. I started thinking about this in a very informal way when I was actually working on my very first book, Fear of a Black America, right? Thinking about the evolution of racism at a systemic level in the United States and how that racism has prevented the country from basically being accepting beyond just tolerance, being accepting of people who are not white, right? Including indigenous people who were here way before white people were, right? So, and thinking about that, and then thinking about everything from everyday stuff. I mean, just little things like me, me, I kind of things with kids who don't know how to behave and don't know where their boundaries are, to things like the U.S. insisting that it's the greatest country in the history of the world, the most powerful country in the history of the world, the richest country in the history of the world, which is a much more sophisticated version of me, I, right? So I began thinking about this really as a topic, like a full-fledged topic about 10 or 11 years ago. And in thinking about it as a topic, I started looking at, has anyone really written about this from a socio-psychological perspective? Has anyone written about this from a sociological or anthropological perspective? And there's some, meaning there's, Tom Wolfe's, what's it called, New Yorker essay from 1977 or 78 about the me generation, about how baby boomers are essentially narcissistic, right? There's books by other people like Christopher Lash, who wrote a book on the on narcissism in the
Cultural
US.
narcissism, yeah.
Yeah, 1980. There's also Gene Twenge and W. Keith Campbell's book, The Narcissism Epidemic from 2009. They've all looked at various from various slices where the US was in real time around narcissism. But they didn't look at it just, they just looked at narcissistic behavior and narcissistic tendencies. They weren't looking at it in terms of connections with other intersections like racism or sexism and misogyny or transphobia or any of those other isms and phobias. So I decided to go ahead and take a closer look at it from that standpoint, but from terms of history, but also in terms of, in terms of American history, but in terms of where America is in the moment that we ended up coming in the age of Trump. So that's how I ended up really starting writing about it in essay form, thinking about it in terms of Trump and his relationship with the American people and how American people see, and him in particular, seem to have many of the signs of what we would call narcissistic personality disorder. I will add really quickly that me having worked very, very briefly as a student and as a graduate student in the field of mental health and working for mental health agencies gave me a chance to actually see narcissism in terms of a psychological diagnosis up close, narcissistic personality disorder specifically. Doesn't mean every American has narcissistic personalities, or it just means that they have narcissistic tendencies that could eventually lend themselves to having the disorder, like lack of empathy for other people, constant self-praise and self-love to the point where no one else seems to matter, this sense of superiority of other people, things like that, right? You need to meet at least five criteria of the narcissistic personality disorder index in order to be considered a full-fledged malignant narcissist. But even having three makes you kind of, not easy to deal with, to say the least.
And there seems to be an insinuation on two fronts here. One, it's you're, I think, implying there's a difference between narcissism and individualism. Many critics might find even the latter unhelpful. And then also, you seem to be making your way toward that the narcissism, pardon me, the narcissism manifests itself both systemically and structurally. First, let's take the first part. Is there an important difference between individualism and narcissism?
No, I would argue that they're essentially one and the same, David, definitely. But I will take a step back and try to introduce another concept, which every human being should be familiar with, which is individuality. We are all individuals. We're not, you know, we're not changelings who, you know, who are made of liquid form and be able to mingle with each other that way. We are actual individuals. But individualism is a way to sort of say that you yourself, you know, it's all about you. It's all about you, your struggles, your triumphs, your failures. So if you fail, it's all on you. If you win, it's all on you, right? And it creates a system of winners and losers. Well, if you take that to its most extreme level, which we see in large measure in our society, then you have a whole bunch of people running around thinking that they're better than other people because they have money, or because they have more degrees, or because whatever the because happens to be, you know, they're more athletic, whatever it is. And when you have that kind of behavior happening on a societal level, it's not just one person that has this problem. It means our society has this problem. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, individualism is just basically a cover for narcissism.
Well, I imagine that you have anticipated and even engaged the pushback of a seeming innocence. I have to take care of myself. I have to take care of my family. I have to do a job. I have to live in a certain living conditions, a house, a neighborhood, what have you. So there's this, let me ruthlessly appropriate what you're saying. There's this guise of innocence that's intertwined or wrapped around what you're observing. How about the second part then?
Okay.
No, you were going to say something in response.
Yeah, I was. I was going to say that I think innocence in this particular case is irrelevant. Okay. It's completely irrelevant. It doesn't matter what you intend to be narcissistic or not, or have narcissistic tendencies, or don't care about other people. We're set in a society that by its own nature doesn't really care about a lot of people. We don't care about the elderly, not the way we should. We don't care about kids, not the way we should. We don't care about the poor, not the way we should. Because we have these extreme gaps in wealth and in treatment, you know, from institutions and everything else. And so if you have all that operating on the norm of society, I'm not sure how relevant being innocent or being 7 years old and not realizing that you don't have any boundaries has to do with it. You live in a society that allows you to do those things. So,
without boundaries, with plenty of license, no doubt.
Pretty much, yeah.
And teasing it a little bit further, I two-parted my question, and the second part was something that goes like this. Some people are overwhelmingly aware that they're manifesting narcissism, but others are not. And I know in examining this book of yours and talking to you in the past that you're concerned about systemic and structural manifestation of this. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Sure. I mean, how does it manifest on a structural and systemic level? Well, let's see. You can start with capitalism. Capitalism is basically, it's just regulated greed. That's what capitalism is. If you really want to just define it and not use lofty terms like the dialectical materialism and all that other
stuff. In our quotidian existence. Yeah.
Right, stuff like that. Then you would just say that, hey, it's just regulated greed. How do we maximize profitability by getting the most productivity out of people with paying them the least amount of money for their product, for the productivity that they've given us, while pocketing all of the profit from whatever they've helped us make? Whether
it's in the meantime, the market is taking care of us, right?
Okay, if that's what you believe, but that's, you know, that's not true, right? So it allows to have and have nots, and allows those who have all the wealth to say that they earned it, right?
Yeah. Right? No one helped them, no social structures.
Yeah, no, not the
government didn't help them.
Yeah, not the 2.3 million workers at Amazon helping Jeff Bezos become one of the three richest people in the world, not the, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who've worked in companies that Elon Musk has invested in for him to become the wealthiest person on earth. No, that they earned all of that, even though there's no logical way they could have actually earned all of that. Capitalism allows them to think that, and that actually is a manifestation of narcissism right there. But then there's also systemic racism in this country, built on the backs of enslaved Africans, built by genociding indigenous people, built and taking their land, built by poor whites who were used for their labor and also to as a wedge between them and enslaved Africans so that they could keep them fighting instead of having to fight poor whites themselves. All of that manifests a sort of narcissism in terms of, you know, rich white men believing that they're essentially the center of the universe, at least the U.S. universe anyway. So,
well, allow me to reintroduce you. We're talking to historian Daniel Earl Collins. Dr. Collins is a contributing writer with Al Jazeera English Opinions and the author of Spinning Stages Gold, Allegories on the Western Dominated Present and a Possible Post-Western Future. So needless to say, you've given us an initial introduction to your idea that America and the West are in a devolution. And I will just ask you to lay claims to something. This is not a recent turn of events, right? You've spent the last few minutes making historical references or allusions that this is a natural outgrowth from inception? Or were there major touch points in our history that you would like for us to notice?
I would say generally that when you set up a system that's essentially a Ponzi scheme, right? Capitalism, imperialism, colonialism, where you're, you know, extracting labor and wealth from other people, and in the process of doing that, just continuing that, at a certain point you run out of resources, right? There's just not enough. There are not enough people, not enough natural resources, not enough wealth to go around for people.
So not a world of ever increasing growth, not a world of never ending resources. No.
Okay. not unless you're mining the sun, right? And it's going to do that, right? So if you in a world like that, it's almost inevitable that people will start fighting over resources, right? Including rich people fighting each over resources. There have been all kinds of inflection points throughout the history of colonial America and the history of the United States as a nation state where this has risen to the fore, whether you're talking about something as small as Bacon's Rebellion in the 17th century, where poor whites fought rich whites in what is Jamestown Colony, for more land and more resources.
And that was an interracial effort, wasn't it?
It was an interracial effort. And, the result, one of the results of that is they started essentially writing laws that linked enslavement specifically to African people. That's what they did to basically drive that wedge between poor whites and free African folk living in Jamestown Colony. So there's that end. But we can be much more recent about it. The American Civil War is a major flashpoint, right? Are we going to have a society built on exploitation of enslaved Africans? Or are we going to have a society where we exploit everybody, for lack of a better way of putting it, but not having them fully enslaved, right? And the latter won out. But in the process, we also forgave, pardoned so many people who are part of an insurrection or rebellion. These are people who are treasonous, who committed treason, and yet they got away with it ultimately in the end.
And reintroduced some of the values and systems that started the trouble in the first place, of course.
Exactly. And then you think about the period since 1945, the U.S. being the world, superpower and, the leader of the free world and the Cold War and the civil rights movement that followed, another inflection point where the U.S. could have done more, but instead decided, let's just say conservative and far right elements within the U.S. said, no, we're not doing but so much. And then once LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, left office in 1969, that effort to try to ameliorate some of the worst effects of Jim Crow segregation, exclusion from workplaces, from schools, from colleges and universities, from the public arena in general, started to stall, and it's obviously slowed down over the course of the last 55 years.
Just to strategically reiterate then, the New Deal was an error. Even the efforts of post-World War II were an error. Civil rights was an error. The Great Society was an error, I guess. And it's all because of narcissism, from your point of view.
Well, so, I would say that, there's those errors counterbalance narcissism.
Because I want to be very clear. Of course, I was being ironic.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, yes, those are errors in which there's some attempt to try to, okay, let's address some of these issues. Let's address racism. Let's address poverty. Let's address whatever inequalities we need to address. But it's at a minimal level. It's sort of an almost begrudging, miserly way to address these things. What I call basically inchworm progress, right? Whether you talk about civil rights era, whether you're talking about the New Deal, these are efforts to try to minimally address issues without hurting too much the pockets of the people who are in power and the people who have the most wealth, right? You don't want to get rid of the system. You just want to tweak it a little bit so that, you know, people don't rise up in arms and try to overthrow it. So
we'll talk about that later in the conversation. But right. As you were talking, you had me think or free associate with up to a certain point with Eisenhower and Kennedy being presidents, income tax rates were pretty high. And, you know, we kind of allowed that to be, but trying to parrot and extend what you're saying, rich people just couldn't sit well with that. Let me take you to a bridge here also that, you know, in writing your opinion editorials and stuff, it's a pretty straightforward process. I'm aware that you use different voices and different devices, but your current project is one of an allegorical reflection. And it's centered around a character named Olivia. But first of all, I want you to talk about why the allegorical reflection and what are you trying to achieve here for your reader, for your audience?
I started this project as a set of essays. I was going to write these different essays that dealt with the relationship between American narcissism or American racism and go on from there, right? Just going to be a collection of essays. But then I realized as I started writing these essays, I was publishing these essays almost as fast as writing them because either Al Jazeera or someone else is interested. And pretty soon I had six essays of these published basically in about 2.5-3 year span. And I'm like, well, publishers aren't necessarily going to be interested in just, you know, here's a collection of essays, even though they should be, but they're generally, they don't like the idea of publishing essays that you've already published in, you know, for news outlets. So I said, well, what else can I do? And I looked at critical race theory as my window for this, right? Critical race theorists like the late Derrick Bell or Patricia J. Williams or Kimberly Crenshaw and others, right, usually an allegory to try to illustrate an inflection point around racism or something and connecting racism with misogyny or misogynoir or connecting it with queer phobia and class distinctions and whatnot, you know, trying to deal with intersectional isms, really, right? And so I decided, well, what would be the best way of doing this? And my methodology was thinking about, well, what does this look like if somehow we were to get to the other side of this and there is no longer a Western-dominated world, we're in a post-Western world, what would that post-Western world look like? What would folks be like in terms of their thinking about the world and thinking back and looking back at the world in which you and I inhabit right now and think, well, how did they mess this up? Why did they have all this wealth and then hoard it and then destroyed the world as they knew it in the process of doing so? Those kinds of questions, you know, that cropped up in my mind and thinking about future, past, and present. And so I decided to create a descendant, whether she's a literal descendant or a spiritual kind of descendant in the name of Olivia, to basically be my vehicle for telling these allegorical tales via a combination of cross-genre work, you know, nonfiction and fictional in these different essays, right?
Almost and kind of like Derek Bell, right?
Yeah, a lot like Derek Bell, hopefully a little bit better than Derek Bell, too, in some respects, right? At least in terms of the way people sound and talk about different things. But the one thing that I wanted to make sure of in thinking this through, too, is, well, the world is so dominated by the thinking of men. I wanted this to be a world where the women are the leaders, especially Black and brown women. Right. Malcolm X talks about how Black women are the most talked about. He's obviously been dead for a while. Talks about how Black women are most disrespected group of folk in the United States. He talked about this before his death before his assassination in 1965. And so I decided to put that on its head and say, what does the world look like where Black and brown women are basically running the world? Right. Because I think in the final analysis, if you really want a post-Western world, you want the people who probably haven't been listened to hardly at all to be the best people, who would probably be the best people to run it, so that it doesn't turn into a world that remains dominated by Western values, Western norms, Western systems. So, hence, Olivia.
And they've done the good work for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Yeah.
So we're.
I mean, think about. Think about Winnie Mandela, right? We act as if Nelson Mandela did all this work from Robben Island from 1963 until 1990 to hold the African National Congress together and hold the entire movement against apartheid together. I'm like, but his wife was out there in the real world dealing with people for all this time. She's just one example, I would say, of how we neglect the fact that Black and brown women really have done a lot of the legwork, and they should really just be in charge at this point in a lot of ways.
Well, we'll find out more about this, and particularly in the character of Olivia. We're talking to historian Donald Earl Collins. You're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, and the topic is freedom versus narcissism. Is our future in jeopardy? We'll be right back after some public service announcements. Please stick with us as our conversation continues. Thank you.
WPFW has offered inspiring music, poignant stories, and critical journalism for over 48 years. Whether reminiscing while hearing Nina Simone or learning about the harm done due to gross global inequity, WPFW has been the soundtrack for moments of revelation, joy, sadness, and resistance. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. We ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our fall pledge drive by donating at WPFWFM.org and additionally from October 12th through the 25th at 800-222-9739. There is only one WPFW and only one you, the listener, who is committed to keeping independent music and message available to the people. Your generosity sustains and challenges us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
On Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents What Breaks the Heart, joining millions around the world and marking 2 years of genocide in Gaza. Through interviews, stories and poetry, the day programming will reflect the cultural and political concept of Palestinian Somali, highlighting the enduring presence, resistance and connection of the Palestinian people to their land. That's What Breaks the Heart, commemorating 2 years of genocide in Gaza. Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW. Building a more compassionate world, one broadcast at a time.
And welcome back to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at 89.3 FM, WPFW, Washington. Also, WPFWFM.org. In existence for 48 years because listeners like yourself choose to financially and socially support this station. I join with staff and 100-plus programmers to thank you for doing that. You did have our gratitude, and we seek to serve you and join with you together to build better communities one broadcast at a time. You're listening to We the People, and our topic is Freedom versus Narcissism. Is our future in jeopardy? Our guest is historian Donald Earl Collins. He's a contributing writer to Al Jazeera English Opinions, and he has a practice as a freelance writer of covering the topics of education reform, social justice, multiculturalism, and American and African-American identity, and American racism and American narcissism. He has done that for more than 20 years, and he's with us. So I've made reference to your book, Spinning Sages Gold, Allegories on the Western-Dominated Present and a Possible Post-Western Future. You implied before we went to break that maybe these changes or transformations, possibly for the better, might take several hundred years. And you've given us a character named Olivia, and it's the we're in somewhere approaching or in the 24th century. Certainly a different world. What is this world that you imagine? And tell us more about Olivia.
Well, the world that I imagine is one that has to figure out how to get rid of American race. Well, not just American, but Western racism or Western narcissism and all of its manifestations, right? And, you know, this is a world that has basically has risen from the ashes of what all of those kinds of values have led to, right? We're in the middle of climate change right now, right? We're in the middle of things happening across the world, including genocides in different parts of the world, including Gaza and Democratic Republic of the Congo and Sudan and other places. We're in the midst of resources running out, right? We've got, you know, there are everything, steel, tin, zinc, you know, lithium, et cetera, running out because water even, their water resources are running out, not just because population has grown, but because the West has kind of hoarded a lot of resources over the last few hundred years. So that can't hold. And so you expect a decline, maybe even a collapse of different nation states across the West, maybe that happens in the next few decades, maybe it takes a couple of centuries, but eventually stuff's going to run out and they're going to fight for these resources, and those fights might be disastrous, right? Hopefully the global South, what we call the third world in the Western part of the world, you know, places across South America, the African continent, South Asia, you know, other parts of the world, pull their resources together, you know, take the lessons of the past about being communal and collectivism and pool resources together to try to deal with the disasters that happen as a result of climate change, as a result of war, as a result of genocide, as a result of resource overutilization and things of that nature. And that can lead to a world where you end up with someone like Olivia and people like her who are keenly aware of what happened in the past and are doing everything in their power to make sure that this past, this Western past, doesn't manifest again. And that includes, of course, things like narcissism and systemic racism.
Well, it's in Olivia being a young person beginning to enter her teen years, not tween years. She's coming out of that. She's surrounded by a distinct community, but I got a sense in paying attention to your work that you're resonating with a present curiosity and a can-do-ism, for lack of a better expression, that young people even reflect today. As an older person, and I imagine many older people may fall into this trap, we don't think that a younger generation values history, values facts, values scientific approach. We don't credit them with being inclusive, and so on and so forth. Olivia, indeed, is a very special character, is she not?
I would like to think that she's an original. Okay. You know, she would probably call herself that if you asked her, hey, if she were literally flesh and blood in the flesh in 21st century, you asked her, what you think of yourself as, she'd probably say, I'm an original. And that would be the end of that sentence. So I would say in response to young people in general, though, in addition to everything else, I've taught at a bunch of places over the last 30 years, especially the previous 18. You know, I used to teach at American University. You know, I recently came off a 2-year stint teaching at Loyola University, Maryland, taught at University of Maryland, University College, among other places over the last, especially the last 18, 20 years. And yeah, there are plenty of young people who don't value history or like, why am I in this course and all that. But there are also younger people who do appreciate it. And for those folks, what you need to do is not just go, well, they're young people, they don't appreciate anything. You teach them as if they should appreciate. You teach them as if there's reason to. You teach them so that they understand that in the final analysis that just because you're 15, 20, 25 years old doesn't mean you shouldn't understand why things are the way they are. Why do you put salt and pepper on eggs? Well, it's a leftover from the rise of imperialism and the hoarding of pepper from South Asia in the 17th and 18th century, right, kind of stuff. You try to make them see that everything that they're doing, culturally speaking, has origins. And those origins are not frequently not good origins, right? Understanding that there's an ugly side to humanity and human history. You want them to understand that. And the parallel that I try to write through Olivia is that Olivia's living in a time that's probably only a century or two, somewhere between a century and 2 centuries after the collapse of the West. Right. It hasn't been long enough for people who have completely forgotten, oh, well, these people fought wars over resources and they might have nuked each other. And they certainly would have fought over resources to the point where people would have starved to death and people would have been genocided over these kinds of things. They're not that far removed from that past. So it would be very important to make sure someone is even as young as Olivia to get this, to get it on some level, right?
And is there anything we should know about the collapse? It's not one cataclysmic event.
Well, in the book, I write about a fictional cataclysmic event involving the Yellowstone caldera explosion, right? There are scientists who predict that anytime within the next 100 to 10,000 years, this caldera is going to explode and kill, hundreds of millions of people and put the entire planet in nuclear winter, right? So I took that concept and said, well, what if some terrorists, particularly white supremacist terrorists, decided we can't live in a country where we're the minority group anymore. We're going to just destroy what we have rather than continue to live like this. And that's sort of where I got the concept for a singular event, but it isn't a singular event. It's one event that's stacked on top of a whole domino effect of events involving climate change, involving war, involving loss of resources and all kinds of other things that leads to folks of the global south who are relatively less touched by all this, because quite frankly, if the West is going to collapse, they're going to fight each other over resources. They might fight China and they might fight India, but they're not fighting the entire global south over all their resources because narcissism. They're the ones who've hoarded it all. So my sort of thinking about this is, okay, that happens. Global South gets itself together in terms of collectivism and collaboration and figures their way out scientifically, intellectually, culturally, all these other things to get to a post-Western world. And Olivia is the beneficiary, quite frankly, of all of that, and people like her.
Well, it seems like you're giving a younger generation not only a sense of wisdom, but they have a sense of agency. Again, I think I said earlier in observing your work that Olivia and her peers are very welcoming and very inclusive and nurturing of each other. And I guess that your attempt to make a striking contrast, of course, over and against narcissism. We talked about that they're well-informed. You talked about that they're living out of a world that's fighting the good struggle of coming out of violence. In fact, they take actions of violence quite seriously and want to do everything to prevent it. Part of that process, I think, is a interesting thing I wanted to ask you about. I found a difference between Olivia and her characters turning to older people and saying, "Didn't you know? Why didn't you do something about this?" It's kind of different than the reality of what we experience with the same questions today. Can you say more about that?
The book isn't specific. I mean, I try to write this book in a way so that if someone, say, someone like me from like when I was between the ages of 10 and 13 picked it up, I'd read it, right? That was the main thing I was thinking about in terms of writing it the way I wrote it. You know, when cross generations, watching Olivia, she grows up, you know, me sort of going back and forth in time in terms of who I am growing up, or some ancestor like me, I should say. And in doing that, I try to think about, well, what would a young person who knows what, who's learned from their grandmother, from her grandparents, from her parents, things that their grandparents told them, because those grandparents actually lived through some of this, and they would say, of course they're going to ask the question, why didn't anyone try to stop this? Why did all this have to happen? Why do millions upon millions of people have to die in order for us to have this different world? And, you know, the difference between what is the lack of encouragement we give younger people to be free to ask those kinds of questions, quite frankly, right? I remember a kid asking folks about, why did slavery have to happen? And, you know, people would shut down that before answering that question for me.
Hey, that begs another question, just a quick interjection. Mm-hmm. Is it because we're not committed, is not useful to our narcissistic tendencies to even talk about that? Therefore, we don't teach or force the issue of teaching about history and context.
Yeah, I think it's even more, I would say it's even a little bit deeper than just narcissism per se. It's narcissism involving other isms as well, like, you know, ageism. How dare you, young person, ask me this question, for example, would be one form of that. But another form of that, to be honest with you, is just the general sense among folks in this day and age that the past is the past. We're living in the here and now. What happened in the past?
No connection whatsoever.
It doesn't matter right now. They just don't get the connections at all. Yes, David, they do. They don't, right? You know, my father does this to me all the time. He wants me to leave his past in the past. And I'm like, but I can't. You know, there are different things we need to discuss in order to get past, in order to deal with it. And
Sankofa principle. We need to reach back in the past and bring it forward.
Yeah. And, You know, to use another example, there's a book by Emma DeBerry known as Twisted, which is about the history of black hair, black hair among African diasporic people, you know, across the Atlantic, in the, you know, U.S., you know, South America, in the British Isles, and in Africa. And one of the things she talks about, it's a big theme, it's something that I picked up on as I was writing my book, is the idea that if you really want to solve the problems of the present, sometimes you need to go back into the past to use the techniques that people used in the past in order to get the present moving toward the future.
Well, you just gave me an opening before I reintroduce you. Olivia is encouraged to talk to the ancestors in different ways.
Right.
And you can say more about that once I reintroduce you.
Okay.
Listeners, you're listening to We the People. I'm your host, David Whetstone, right here at your Jazz and Justice radio station, WPFW 89.3 FM, WPFWFM.org. Importantly, as I often say, I want you to focus on our topic and particularly what our guest offers. We're talking about freedom versus narcissism. Is our future in jeopardy? Our guest is historian Donald Earl Collins. He's not only a historian, but the contributing writer with Al Jazeera English Opinions. Dr. Collins, again, thank you for being with us. We're running out of time, unfortunately, sir. And I just want to say that you have reasons for creating a world, again, hundreds of years from now, 24th century. Boundaries and geography, which often define our politics, are certainly different. There's the whole notion of the nation state is turned on its head. Young people are very active. Multiculturalism is at play. And I don't know if I'm forgetting other elements that you want to lift up. So why don't you go ahead and again tell me why you create this allegory and you cast this world, a world where there's an Ida B. Wells Day. Where young people demand that education is more than behavior modification. Again, what is this world that you want to offer us through this allegory?
Well, numerous black feminist authors talk about the idea of how to get free, right? How do we get free? And so everything that I write in Spinning Sage's Gold is about how do we as a people, and I mean all of humanity, I'm not trying to exclude white people from being free. I just want to make sure that because they're the ones who are have been in charge for so long, that they are most susceptible to falling back into old habits, right? And so I talk about that as a major theme in the book. But with Olivia and all the people she's growing up around, And by the way, she's growing up in a world where there are no nation states. She's living in a region of the world, the Southern Cone, right? She's the descendant of black folk from the U.S. and African black folk simultaneously. So, you know, a lot of migration has to happen for this world to take place, too.
Open borders. Oh, my.
Yeah, no borders. I know. Well, you can't afford to have borders if every coastal city in the world is underwater, right? If climate change goes as far as it goes, right? So with Olivia and the person that she is, that happens, again, it happens because so much has happened that shows how crappy the world can become, right? How violent the world can be, that you're living with people who are the descendants of people who said, we've got to rebuild this thing from the ground up, get rid of systemic racism, get rid of, you know, laws that allow for slavery and exploitation of workers. Heck, let's get rid of capitalism altogether. Let's get rid of currency. So many things have to happen to make that happen. And so Olivia is this person who's lived in this world and has been empowered to be the freest she can possibly be. I've created her character to be someone we would call in the 21st century as pansexual, right? Right. She does, her sexuality is completely unbound, right? Someone like a Janelle Monáe, right, who calls herself pansexual, by the way, right? And thinking about that and thinking about black and brown women in leadership, I realized, well, if if anybody in a group of people are going to want to be the most free, it's going to be Black and brown women. So why not allow them to be as free as they could possibly be, sexually, religiously, culturally, politically, and in so many ways, shapes, and forms. And so the idea for this book is to take all these notions that we have, all these Western notions of patriarchy, of what Black men are supposed to be, you know, we're supposed to be taught and sound like this and all this other stuff about how white men are supposed to be in charge, and just take all that away and allow these people to roam free in every way, shape, or form that they could possibly do, and see what kind of world that they can create in doing that.
Well, thank you, Donald Earl Collins. Again, Dr. Collins is a historian, and he's a contributing writer with Al Jazeera English Opinions, and the author of his latest book, Spinning Sages Gold, Allegories on the Western-Dominated Present and a Possible Post-Western Future. Dr. Collins, again, thank you for being with us on We the People.
Thank you for having me, David. Appreciate it.
Listeners, I'm glad that you joined us for this hour. I'm glad you stuck with us. I am particularly happy and thankful for those listeners who choose to support WPFW, your Jazz and Justice radio station, again, over 48 years. I would not be able to thank you and show my appreciation without my engineer, Mike Nasella, without the News and Public Affairs Department of WPFW, and the rest of the WPFW staff, along with programmers, 100 in number, bringing you such things as Sophie's Parlor from 3 to 5, Music and Culture by the oldest women's collective in public broadcasting. Earlier at 2, Zen El Amin and Shewanana covering Middle Eastern affairs. At 1 p.m., Moise Mutali and James Pope with Africa Now, African descended people and matters thereof, not only on the continent but throughout the world, throughout the diaspora. And I would be remiss not to say, don't forget the blues, our Wednesday edition coming up next with Clarence the Blues Man Turner. Thank you for being with us. Perhaps we'll meet again on the radio. Take good care. And again, thanks.
Tanner Park in Effington. The celebration continues with a day of music and culture featuring Junkyard Band, Brandon Woody, plus performances showcasing Latin rhythms and African beats. The festival also brings together live DJ sets, record fair, vendors, community activities for all ages. Details at homebrewmusicfestival.com.
If you're a WPFW supporter, please take a moment and record a testimonial as to why you support Jazz and Justice Radio on our testimonials hotline at 202-588-0796. Messages must be 1 minute or less. It is with your generosity that we are able to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. And we thank you.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, asking you to support WPFW. We ask you, please, to go to the website and make a pledge, maybe $47 or $470 if you can, or $47 a month, to WPFW.org. Hey, if you want to get dinner and a show in New York, if you want to bring a guest with you, maybe your partner or daughter or son, a friend you want to meet up with in New York, watch the broadcast of Democracy Now! Live, 8 in the morning, sit on the set as we broadcast on over 1,000 stations, and then I get to personally host you for a meal, and we will toast WPFW, and it is an amazing time. We call it dinner and a show, you and your special guest. That's a $2,000 tax-deductible charitable contribution that goes directly to WPFW. Go online at WPFW.org. And by the way, you don't have to know when you can come to New York, where Democracy Now! Is based. Just make that call or go online at WPFW.org, make the pledge, and then we'll get in touch with you and work out the details. Maybe you're coming to New York soon, or it won't be for a year. This doesn't expire because we don't want WPFW to expire. Again, go to WPFW.org. And thank you so much.
Attention all parents and youth in the Washington, D.C. area. Looking for a creative, inspiring after-school program? The Word Speeds and Life Academy in Columbia Heights fall session begins September 22nd. For ages 8 to 18, we offer classes in poetry, DJing, graffiti art, college prep, and more. Elementary classes are Mondays and Tuesdays, with youth and young adults on Wednesdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m. Located at 1525 Newton Street Northwest in Columbia Heights, starting September 22nd. It's the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy. More info at wblinc.org/academy.
All right.
WPFW has offered inspiring music, poignant stories, and critical journalism for over 48 years. Whether reminiscing while hearing Nina Simone or learning about the harm done due to gross global inequity, WPFW has been the soundtrack for moments of revelation, joy, sadness, and resistance. It's your generosity that allows us to continue this tradition of expansive, emancipatory excellence in community radio. We ask you to once again be in solidarity with WPFW during our fall pledge drive by donating at WPFWFM.org and additionally from October 12th through the 25th at 800-222-9739. There is only one WPFW and only one you, the listener, who is committed to keeping independent music and message available to the people. Your generosity sustains and challenges us to build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Jim Byers, host of the Latin Flavor Classic Edition. Support from listeners like you are the tools that have built WPFW over nearly 5 decades. We provide news, music worth listening to, and in-depth conversations about your community and the world. One of the many ways that you could contribute is to donate a vehicle that you no longer need, running or not. It can do wonders for WPFW, so donate it for a tax break for 2024. Go to WPFWFM.org or call 1-866-WPFW-CAR. That's 1-866-973-9227 for more information. Help WPFW continue building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Oh, shit.
On Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight, WPFW presents What Breaks the Heart, joining millions around the world and marking 2 years of genocide in Gaza through interviews, stories, and poetry. The day programming will reflect the cultural and political concept of Palestinian Sumud, highlighting the enduring presence, resistance, and connection of the Palestinian people to their land. That's What Breaks the Heart, commemorating 2 years of genocide in Gaza. Tuesday, October 7, 5 a.m. until midnight on WPFW. Building a more compassionate world, one broadcast at a time.